And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Dr. Keith Klosterman returns. He is a marriage and family therapist, and we have discussed so many aspects of mental health and its effect on relationships and the family over the past few years. Welcome back.
Thank you. So good to be with you again.
As many of you know, Beasley Best Community of Caring this month is talking about suicide prevention, and that's where our conversation is going to go today. As I said, we've mentioned mental health on each of our conversations. And one of the things that I mentioned before we began taping today was, is it safe to say that signs of mental illness are not necessarily the same signs of suicide ideation?
Yes, that's definitely correct. So not everyone who has a mental illness is suicidal or will be suicidal. So I think that those are different things. There are certainly risk factors for suicide and suicidal behavior. But just because someone has a mental illness does not mean that they are or they will be suicidal.
It's a really bad, ugly Venn diagram that a lot of families are going to be surprised, I guess, when there is a death by suicide or an attempt at suicide.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I think oftentimes it's the people closest to us that are the last ones to notice or to see the symptoms. Or it may be hard for somebody to share the struggle and the despair that they're going through. So I think, yes, in some cases, it will catch people off guard because they just don't know what to look for, or they don't realize the extent or severity of the suicidal ideation. Sometimes, and especially in the case of kids, parents might think that it's attention seeking. Oh, you're just saying that kind of behavior, when in fact, it's a sign of something else, something more deeper seated and troubling.
Let's break it down. Mental illness versus suicide ideation.
Well, so I think they're two separate entities, if you will. So mental illness can range from depression, anxiety, adjustment disorder. There's a whole host, a whole spectrum of different disorders that somebody could suffer from. Suicidal ideation is somebody having thoughts about hurting themselves in some way or taking their life. And that can range from passive thoughts to, I don't really want to be here, or I wish I wouldn't wake up, to something more concrete and specific that not only do I not want to be here or not wake up, but here's how I'm going to do it, and here's when I'm going to do it. In general, the more concrete and specific someone is about how they would take their life, typically the greater the likelihood they're going to do it. So if somebody says, well, I'm going to go home this afternoon, and I'm going to hang myself at 2 o'clock in the garage, and I have access to the rope and I have everything set up. Those are some really scary red flags, right? Versus somebody that says, well, I'm going to go to San Francisco and jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, but I don't have access to transportation. I don't have the money to get there. And so I think it depends on, usually what we say is, you assess on a case-by-case basis. And to be clear, there aren't any particular causal factors that we'd say, but what we know is that there are a number of risk factors. And the more risk factors that you have compared to protective factors, which would be supports, people that you can talk to, things that you can do, when the risk factors pile up, or if you think of sort of like a teeter-totter, and it's weighted down with all those risk factors, and there's not a whole lot of support, that's when we begin to ask more specific and pointed questions about, you know, are you thinking of killing yourself, and how would you do it, and so on. That helps us understand what's the correct level of need for this particular person at this particular point in time.
Do I ask you now about those risk factors?
Sure. I mean, they can look like eating and sleeping patterns are different. So someone's not eating, someone's not sleeping, somebody may not be taking medication as prescribed. There may be a precipitating event. Maybe somebody lost their job. A family history of suicide ups the ante. A previous attempt ups the ante. Again, a concrete and specific plan with access to the means or the methods. All of those things, as you're sort of thinking about it, you know, the more the answers are affirmative, where it's like, check that box, check that box, all of that ups the risk, the potential level of risk.
So it's a case of not necessarily watching the individual, but counting the individual's life circumstances at a time.
Correct. Like, let's say, for example, that you have a friend who is totally unmotivated, doesn't want to get out of bed anymore. Really uncharacteristic for this person. Person starts maybe giving things away. Person isn't future oriented. Judgment is really bad. When you notice these stark changes in behavior, I think that's when you start to ask the question, how are you doing? Is everything okay? Can I help you? What's going on for you? It's important to have transparent conversations about what you notice with the people that you care about and love.
I don't remember if we brought this up yet or not, but the age that suicide, but death by suicide occurs is getting younger and younger and higher up on that cause of death count. And dealing with children and teens and suicide ideation, that's going to be a different animal, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. And I think the way that you handle that is different depending on the age level. So, someone who's, let's say, 5 years old developmentally may not have the cognitive capacity to understand the finality of what that means. So, a kid may say that, 5-year-old may say that because he didn't get his way and he's upset, right? And he's angry and he's saying that out of frustration and anger. That being said, you still want to process what does that mean to that particular 5-year-old? Right? What's it really about? What's behind it? What's the intention of saying that? Versus a teenager who makes similar statements and has the cognitive capacity can understand what that means. So I think it's the way you handle it is different. The types of conversations that you have are different. With the teenager, for example, asking directly, "Are you thinking of killing yourself?" It's really important. There's a myth that goes around that people are sometimes afraid. They're afraid to ask the question because they're afraid that somehow they're going to put the idea into someone's head. That's not the case. Someone isn't going to hear you say that and then say, "Oh, I hadn't thought of that." Usually, by the time you say that to somebody, if they are thinking that way, in some ways it can be a bit of a relief that somebody wants to know, that the person gets a chance to say what's really going on. Because in many cases, people don't ask, and maybe because they're afraid of what the answer could be.
I can't remember where I read this. It might have been at the AFSP site, but that it's always safe to assume you are the only person who is going to ask that question.
Yes, and it can be really powerful. People that end up suiciding, it's not because they want to die, right? It's because they've run out of options or they've run out of hope. It's not that they want to actively take their life, but life has become so challenging and they have so much despair that they can't see any other option, right? So they're in this crisis mindset where they just don't see possibilities. So it's really important that we ask about how are you feeling? Are you thinking of doing this? How can I help you? How can I support you? Or also at times suggesting, look, you'd benefit from getting some help. Maybe talking to somebody would be really helpful. Again, recognizing not everyone's going to have the language of a clinician, right? The average person won't. But what the average person can do is to encourage that individual to get help.
And of course, help now is so easy to find. 988, just if you are in a crisis or if you need words of advice for dealing with someone you fear might be coming to a crisis situation, 988 is the number to call for actual help from a mental health specialist. Making this part of the family conversation, making it part of your family dynamics, if the stats are always quoted as that 1 in 5 of us will have some type of a mental illness, a mental health disorder at some point in our life. So obviously, everybody is going to either have it or have a family member, or it's going to be a lived experience for all of us. How does one cope and maintain a family dynamic, or I should say, a family existence when you do have a diagnosed mental health issue within the family?
Well, so I think your question's a good one, and there's a couple things to consider. One is the scope, the other is the severity. So everyone in life goes through challenges and they hit adversity where at times maybe they meet criteria for an anxiety disorder or a depressive disorder, but it doesn't mean that it's a chronic situation. It could be some people experience chronic depression, some people it's more acute in nature. So it depends on the scope of what you're dealing with. I think in those conversations or in those situations, having conversations about what's happening for that person and coming from a place of wanting to help or encouraging that person to get help, it can be hard when somebody's struggling to have the clarity to recognize, hey, I'm feeling different and I need to get help. I think having transparent conversations within a family about what that means, and also encouraging family members to take care of themselves if somebody that they live with is struggling with a mental illness. You know, there's a lot of therapy and medication can be really helpful, especially the medication side tends to work best when it's done in conjunction with some kind of talk therapy. At least that's what the data show. So if somebody is getting help, they can see tremendous gains in progress. If somebody isn't willing to get help, then I think it becomes about the other people within the family doing things to make sure that they're taking care of themselves within that, because that can be a really stressful environment.
That's what I was trying to get to here. A family continues on, no matter what is happening with the individual. The family still has to get to school, get to work, live in the neighborhood, maintain the family property, etc. You've got all of these demands on the family, and yet you're also dealing with this as an issue too. And what can a family do, especially if there is someone who is not looking for help?
So I think that the other family members themselves can seek out help, whether it's through therapy, whether it's support groups, whether it's even just different community activities where they can, things that they can get involved in that may be either some kind of distraction or may provide additional help and support. I also think, you know, all the while sort of encouraging the individual to get help. Sometimes timing matters, and I think these conversations shouldn't be a one-off, but more of an ongoing conversation. And so sometimes you may initially approach somebody about the need or the benefit of getting help, and they may not be receptive to it. But over time, maybe something happens, and revisiting that, it doesn't have to be this way, or maybe it could be different. Maybe there would be value in getting help. Sometimes people are more willing to do it then, especially, as I said, if there is a contributing factor that maybe slows a person down and says, hey, you know what? I need to do something different.
Well, with a mental health diagnosis, you mentioned, it could be chronic, it could just be an acute situation that time will resolve, time and treatment will resolve. But again, you know what you're wrestling there. And when you have a suicide, a death by suicide, or an attempted suicide, that can really come out of the blue for these families. How about coping in those kind of situations?
I think that it's every family's worst nightmare. And so I think, you know, depending on the outcome, I think having family support, having a forum for family members to talk about what it is they're going through and how they're dealing with it. If there is a completed suicide, talking, each person having the space to grieve and to talk about what it was that they went through. Everyone will grieve in their own way. And it's not right or wrong. It's each person trying to work through the pain of what they're experiencing and the heartache and heartbreak, what they've gone through. In a situation where somebody didn't know and the suicide wasn't complete, it was an attempt, but the person lived. I also think having really transparent conversations about what that means for everyone in the family, including the individual, and how scary that would be. My guess is families that I've worked with in this case, many families worry that, you know, could this happen again? And can I trust that if you say you're going to go out and do something that, you know, you're going out with friends, that that's what you're doing and that I don't have to worry? And I think that's really hard. And I think it takes time. It's not something that can be put back together overnight. I think there has to be a commitment to sort of processing and coming out the other side of it. Of course, different, but recognizing that all of us are struggling in our own way.
I was going to ask you about the trust factor in this, especially between partners. And is this a betrayal? You're trying to leave me. You are affecting our family. You've made a unilateral decision, trust factor. And then the same thing between a parent and a child. Again, is this a trust that has now been broken?
Well, I think it's, you know, I don't know that it, I think that the behavior is a symptom of deeper seated issues. And so it's not, it, although it can feel like, hey, that's really selfish, right? Like, how could you do this to me? How could you do this to our family? I think that it's a symptom of what's happening in that person's life. And it's not that the person wants to do that, but again, has run out of options. So I think being aware that this is a function of the depth of despair that the person's feeling. And I think the trust piece takes time, right? Like, you can't rebuild trust overnight. And I think the way you go about doing it is with transparency and honesty, and even honesty about, you know, I worry all the time. I'm scared, right? I'm scared for you. I'm scared for our family. And I think having those conversations and being able to talk about it is a really important part of the process.
I did turn it around, didn't I? I don't know why, but I suspected that that would be, or I expected that that would be a common response, that you don't think about the individual, you think about how it affects you yourself and your family, your possession, your thing.
Well, I think that's just a normal human reaction. I think that some people will see it as that, especially if there's young kids in the home, right? How could you do this to us? What are you thinking? Right. And the initial thought, maybe we've got everything, right? We have the perfect family and the picket fence and the two kids and the dog. And so how could you do this? But I think it's not about that, right? It's a symptom of whatever else the person is going through, and trying to figure out, what's the best way to help this particular person? What does this person need? How can we all support one another in this so we don't end up in this situation again? Or if things do start to get tricky, or if they start to get scary again, what can we do to make sure that we don't get to that place anymore, right? What are some of the safety pieces that we can put in place to help all of us?
You know, that is going to be my next direction here, because the most important part of this is suicide prevention, and nipping it in the bud, or recognizing it early enough, or working towards options that this doesn't even join the discussion to begin with. It's not on the table like that. And is it possible to raise kids or support a spouse in a way that you're practicing suicide prevention daily?
Well, I think the way to do that in some ways is just having conversations, communication about what's going on for each person, what's happening in their life. How can we, you know, being the person that, whether it's your partner or your kids, can come to and feel safe, right? That they're not going to be told what they need to do or they should do, or they're not going to get in trouble for saying that they're feeling this way or told that they shouldn't feel this way. So I think, you know, the way to, in some ways, inoculate yourself or families as best you can is that you're able to communicate about what's happening in each person's life and to be involved, right? To sort of understand what is going on, you know, and not in a helicopter or micromanage kind of way, but to just understand what's happening in your child's life, your partner's life, whatever that may be.
How can you maintain this discourse, this conversation about mental health, without it becoming a conversation about mental health? You know, almost like, well, we're checking off the box this week. How was your week, darling? How was school? Oh, how's your mental health this week? Is this a something that can just occur naturally and organically?
But I think that's such a great question. And it's not, because people don't talk that way, right? How's your mental health this week? Like we just don't, most average people don't have those kinds of conversations. They don't use that kind of language. But I do think that it's not that you have to ask the question directly, but being involved and responsive to other people in your life allows you to get a picture of what's happening for them. Paying attention to changes in their mood, paying attention to what your note patterns over time. You know, I think all of those things indicate, if you see somebody that all of a sudden is behaving uncharacteristically for that particular person, as I mentioned earlier, let's say the person who's always up and doing things and upbeat and going out and doing these things, all of a sudden now is having a hard time getting out of bed or doesn't want to do anything, doesn't want to talk to anybody, right? That would warrant a conversation about, hey, what's going on? Notice this. And it's not just a one-off because, to be clear, everybody has a bad day, right? Having a bad day is, that's life. That's all of us. Everybody feels anxious from time to time, right? So we all have our moments. It's when we begin to see these things and they start to, all of these risk factors start to build up, right? That's when we start to say, well, what's really going on?
For a moment there, it sounded like we were heading towards that building a resilient child conversation, of being prepared for ups and downs from an early age, coping skills.
Well, I think so, right? I mean, I think that's part of life. At some point, no matter how much we want to protect our kids, they will deal with adversity. And adversity will show itself in different ways, whether that's with social relationships with other kids, whether it's with grades, interactions with teachers, right? Or just general disappointment or early heartbreak. We can't protect our kids from that, but we can teach them skills, right, and values, and help them to understand that, yes, you will encounter these things, but the way that you manage it is really important. There's some things that you do that will probably help you. There's other things that you do to cope that may not be helpful, and in fact can create more problems. And those are the conversations.
How do you start that conversation, and how do you recognize one that is going down the wrong rabbit hole? There's a rabid dog at the other end.
I think, trying to understand what's the motivation behind some of these behaviors, right? What is it that you're really trying to get out of this? And I think if we're talking about teenagers, sometimes teenagers don't have that big picture focus, right? Everything is on the immediate. And I think maybe helping a kid to sort of see a bigger picture, right? What's the end game in all of this, right? So let's say that you play this out and you fail out of school or you're doing all these other things. What's the end game? Where does this lead? Where are you going? How does that fit with who you want to be and what you want to do with your life? And is there a connection there? I think for parents, it's hard. I think sometimes you can know what to say and you can say all the right things, but your kids will hear it different because of the relationship that you have with them. And it's almost, I've heard someone say that it's almost like you have to try to come up alongside a kid and to have this conversation. Because if you have it, like if you think of it face to face, it ends up feeling adversarial or you telling a kid what to do as opposed to sort of being on the journey with them, if that makes sense.
Well, then, is it possible to have a wrong conversation? If talking is the idea, is it possible to have a wrong one?
Sure. I think we all do it all the time, every day. I think that we have to be able to practice what we preach. So, we want our kids to be accountable and responsible, and words matter. And I think that when we make the mistakes, if we say something that maybe we speak out of emotion and we're harsh or overly punitive, I think circling back and having that conversation of, look, I didn't handle that great. Probably could have handled it better, and I'm sorry. I think we model, kids learn more by what they see than what they read or what they do. And so I think what we model matters. And I think modeling that kind of communication, modeling that level of vulnerability in terms of saying, look, I screwed it up. I'm sorry I did it this way, and I'm going to be more mindful. I think that those are the kinds of conversations that matter.
I was going to ask you for magic words to start to open conversation, but instead it sounds more like be prepared before you begin.
Yes, for sure, right? And I think it's being real. We know, we all know when we've made a mistake, right? And I think to just sort of sweep it under the rug or, well, I'm the parent, you're the kid, this is just the way it is, get used to it, and I love you, like that. I think being transparent about what your intent is and maybe why you feel that way. A parent coming across, let's say, intensely or maybe over the top, the kid feels the intensity, but maybe the intent of it is, I'm worried about you. I'm really worried about you, and I'm really scared. That's the piece that doesn't get said. that's the piece that the kid doesn't hear. The kid just sees the behavior, the parent's behavior flipping out, right? It's like the parent that says, I want you to tell me everything, right? And then so then the kid says, well, okay, well, this is what I'm going through. And then the parent loses it, totally freaks out. The message that the kid internalizes is, I'm not doing that again, right? That didn't work. So I think it's like being able to sort of check yourself and to think about, well, what is it? Why am I freaking out? Why am I upset? Maybe because I'm worried and I'm scared. That's a legitimate reason. That gets heard differently than if you sort of respond out of emotion.
What about we all of this conversation, and now that we're out of time, I'm going to ask, what if we flip the situation and it's a child who loses a parent?
I think that that is something where finding support for kids early on is really, and again, it's going to depend on the developmental age of the child, but I think having support, encouraging conversations as much as the person is willing to talk, right? Like it's sort of like giving permission to say, I feel really sad, and I really miss mom or dad or whomever it is, right? And to acknowledge that and say, you know what, I do too. I think allowing permission to feel those big feelings is really, really important, but also respecting that everyone gets there in their own way and on their own time.
Homework for a family. What's your recommendations? Are there resources for someone who just wants to read up or look into this?
So I think like in terms of the suicidality piece, I think there's lots of good resources, NIH resources. You mentioned the American Suicide Foundation. I think that that's a good, they have tons of good information. The nice thing that we're seeing now is we've seen improvements in terms of these public campaigns of normalizing mental illness and being able to talk about it and telling somebody. So I think, there's lots of good material on the web. I would suggest .org. Instead of .com resources, they tend to be, I don't know if I'd say more reputable, but they're just, that they've been vetted, let's say. So I think like, the web has lots of good resources and materials for that. I think in terms of having conversations with kids, generally looking up some parenting resources on how to have conversations, and depending on whether it's teenagers or young children, what's the appropriate way to do that. And there's lots of books available too. I
And parting words.
think these are really difficult conversations. And I want to be super clear. Someone who has suicidal ideation or is experiencing suicidal ideation doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily attempt to take their life. In some ways, and especially with teenagers, some amount of suicidal ideation is normal. It's a normal part of development. There are times, as I mentioned earlier, where people say, I wish I wasn't here today. I'm having a really bad day. But with that being said, when you notice the risk factors, when you notice significant changes in behavior, and people are making statements about her, even thinly veiled statements, I think it's really, really important to ask. Sometimes it's the best thing you can do is to ask somebody, are you thinking of hurting yourself? Are you thinking of killing yourself? So asking does not mean that you're putting the suggestion in somebody's head. It just means that you care.
So listen and watch, pay attention and question.
Well, yes, and which is in our right, and the way things are today is difficult with all of the distractions built into daily lives with technology, and we live busy lives and fast paced, and so I think it's that slowing down and being present with the people that we care about really matters.
I love that, being present. Thank you. Thank you again for taking the time today to discuss this with us. My guest, Dr. Keith Klosterman, a marriage and family therapist with words of advice for us all. Again, don't be afraid to look up information. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention at AFSP.org is a valuable resource. Of course, as I mentioned before, if you are in a crisis yourself, a loved one, a friend, a co-worker, if you suspect that there might be a problem, you can always call for advice, and that is 988 for a professional response. 988, 24 hours a day. It is staffed by mental health professionals. 988. Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
Be present. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.